November 15th, 1976. I'm talking with Sophie Silver in her home in Hollywood, California. Sophie, you told me that your family came to America in 1913?
Yes.
From Russia?
From the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Why did you happen to end up in Chicago? Did you have relatives there?
My father had a brother who had come here years earlier, and so did my mother have a brother. So that was the main reason why we came to Chicago.
They both lived in Chicago?
They both lived in Chicago at that point.
Did they work in the garment industry?
No. In fact, I'm the only one of the whole family that ended up in the garment industry.
Was your family politically radicalized in the Soviet Union? Russia then.
They were. In fact, my father, who really was a businessman in Russia,
mm-hmm.
or in Ukraine, but in the time when we lived there. My mother was a very unusual woman who died only 6 years ago at the age of 98, and who till her dying day was very alert, very much concerned about what's happening in the world, read the daily press, and was concerned not only about her own family's condition and what's happening in the country, but she had a worldwide outlook. Even though my father was a businessman, the condition under the Tsar, even in the Ukraine, was such that the Jews did not have freedom of education. They were limited. And traditionally, this is the Jewish drive for education and knowledge. My father did not want to come to the United States. But my mother corresponded with her relatives without my father knowing about it, and succeeded what was the practice in those days, that they had sent transportation from Chicago mm-hmm. to the area where we lived for the entire family. And we were five children at that time. I have a sister that was born in the United States after leaving. Naturally, my mother had to tell my father that we are ready to go to the United States. In the meantime, the relatives that were corresponding with my mother, and I have two older brothers, and then I said, since you're bringing children, at that time my brothers, let's say, were 14 and 16 years old, you better teach them some trade, because in the United States everybody has to go to work, and if you have a trade, you're liable to make, not liable, but you are making a better living. So when my mother revealed what she has done, and then my father read the letter, and he had no intention at that time, even though he spent some time in jail for harboring so-called revolutionaries, which was illegal at that time, but they were our relatives. He had dreamt and hoped that his children would be professional. But my mother, who was a very domineering and very principled, she had succeeded in making an agreement with my father that he will take the three older children, which were my two brothers and myself, mm-hmm. go to the United States, and if he, within a year, he will not like it, then we will all come back.
And she was to stay in Russia?
And she was to stay in Russia with two children. And in fact, the youngest sister at that time that we left was only 11 months old. When we came here, the war was already on the horizon in Europe. And the relatives here had convinced my father that he better bring the rest of the family quickly to the United States, or, you know, we will be separated forever.
Yeah.
Which we did, which my father did. And mother and the other children came 6 months later. This was our arrival into the United States.
Did you live with relatives? And within some of the reading that I've done, said that a lot of the Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe lived in communities, kind of within among themselves and within themselves?
Well, as I said before, we had relatives here. The relatives were the petty businessmen. They've been rich here for many years. They did not have the same revolutionary spirit that my folks had. They were like a grocery store, and my father's brother had a farm in Michigan. And then, I must say, I was pretty deep for my age. I was 11 years old, and supposedly I came on a half a fare.
Mm-hmm.
And where the immigrants have to board when they called out their names, and you have to appear, you know. Well, even the immigrants just roared out in laughter. They wouldn't believe it, that I was only 11 years old. The reason why I'm making this remark is that the family, that the relatives that we came to, that whom we lived with this brother that had a farm, my father, my two brothers, and myself, they had a little grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we lived in the back of the grocery store. It was very, very difficult for us even to get used to that type of living. But they've insisted that the four of us that came here, we must go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And while they send us there, we have to repay it.
Mm-hmm.
It was not like the later immigrants came after the Civil War in Russia, after
mm-hmm.
the Revolution, where they came and the immigrants already were better off financially, etc.
Yeah.
So I went to work as soon as I...
At 11?
At 11. I was supposed to have been 12 in September. My birthday was in September, and we came here in January.
Mm-hmm.
And it took probably 4 or 6 weeks. I was dressed in the... I still remember a long skirt. And actually, my long hair that was braided when I came, it had to be put up. And some neighbor, whom I didn't even know, but whom my relatives knew, took me in the factory to work. And this is how my working career started.
So you started working at 11 in the garment industry.
Because even at that time, I realized later, child labor laws had already begun to come in.
Oh.
I had registered for 18. No one questioned, even probably those that suspected that I was not 18. No employer questioned my age. And for 6 long years, I was 18 years old.
Did you work in the same shop?
No.
6 years?
No. I did not. Excuse me.
What kind of work did you do?
My older brother especially, who was very much concerned, and who was already at that time, I believe, 17 or 18 years old, and also because of my parents' background, was imbued with the spirit of education, etc.
Mm-hmm.
He saw to it that while we had to go to work, that we would all go to night school.
So you had a double day.
So that's right. And you see, and we lived in the back of the store that my aunt, who's veteran, who helped out in the store when, you know, we come home from work. It was just the time when she would be very busy in the store and we weren't able to have our dinner. By the time we'd come back from night school, it was too late already. So we really went through a trying time until mother came with the children. And as I told you, mother was for that time and that age, of having a Jewish background, she was an exceptional woman. So she gathered
the flock.
But since the question of returning the money came up, my father's brother, who also had a farm in Michigan, he escorted my mother and the two smaller children on the farm. And we still remained in Chicago, and we would go out to see mother during to spend the weekend
mm-hmm.
with mother. You know, from Chicago to Michigan on the farm, it's an overnight boat trip. So Friday, we would all meet and take the boat and go to the farm. not only visit with mother, but tell mother I'll Sunday night come back by the night boat to Chicago, go to work, come home from work, go to school, and then, and it was a physical hardship.
Oh, yeah.
And mother again, she saw, they reached the thing, I wonder if you...
You were talking about how your mother finally
came. What really prompted my mother to once again to reunite the family and lead a normal family life was that while they were on the farm and we were in the city, all of us working, the routine was that the day of our pay, we would bring the money over to our uncle. He deducted it for expenses and part of it to pay back the money that they sent us and just give us fair character. Well, one Friday when I got my pay, I decided I did not want to turn in all my checks to my uncle and decided to buy myself a pair of shoes instead. The shoes, I remember so vividly, cost $3.50, which at that time consumed almost my entire paycheck because my pay was only $4.50.
For the whole week?
For the whole week. My uncle was so incensed at what I had done that instead of us going to Michigan on the farm, he went to the farm and raised with my mother. What kind of a children did she raise that they dared to do a thing like that? And my mother felt that that was enough. And she came back into the city and we continued. And undoubtedly, after mother came back, and we had reunited as a family unit, and her desire was, especially for me, but even for my other brother, that we go back to school, and the other children were too small yet to go to school, which we were planning to do. And naturally, we had to continue working in order to buy a few things, and incidentally, the very first piece of furniture that we bought, which was through the efforts of my brother, because he sort of assumed the upbringing of the family. He bought a piano.
Oh, how nice.
And I, being the oldest girl, had to really have to take piano lessons and crowd it in together with the work in school and everything else. And then my mother would reprimand me that the neighbor's little girl, who takes lessons for as long as I do, plays much better than I do. And I would say, Mother, but I have no time to practice. And she would tell me, when you play, no one is interested how many hours you spend. I don't know if you want that up.
I do, yes. I do.
Well, however, an unfortunate thing happened. My mother had an accident in the house, and she was bedridden for almost a year and a half. And the plans for me going full-time to school during the day just couldn't materialize. We needed the money, and an additional burden came on, and that is to help take care of the household, you know, because
right.
She was bedridden, and all of us pitched in. And I remember how we lived during that time, that I had one skirt and blouse, and at night I would wash the blouse, and in the morning before I'd go to work, we had these irons that we put it on the stove to heat, I would iron it and be able to
wear it to work. How many hours a day did you work?
Oh, I remember when I started working, I worked 10 hours a day.
5 days a week?
Five and a half days a week.
For $4.50.
For $4.50, yeah. But I must say that those years of hardship, even until today, when I think of them, which I don't do very often, but occasionally when I do, it is more not in fun that I thought it was fun, but I look upon it and I think to myself, well, I was part of a whole generation that had lived through these things. But no bitterness. I believe the reason why there's no bitterness or horrible feelings of that time was because of the spirit of my mother, who always foresaw that there is going to be a better future for us, and who, especially at the beginning, dreamt that in this land of freedom, her children will be able to get a good education and become human beings without fear of reprisals.
When you went to work at 11, how long after that did you become aware of the union? Was there a union in your shop, or?
No.
I from the reading I've done, I understand that the Garment Workers Union has a long tradition of
yes.
socialist and revolutionary ideas and involvement, and just wondering when you got involved.
Well, I did not become a member of the ILG, of the union, until 1933. I started working in the industry in 1932. I gave you the background that I started working, and I worked in some small shops and some bigger shops. I was young and could not compete with some of the makers, so I would constantly be in search of work, and I would just accept anything that came along.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was 16 years old, a friend of my brother, who worked in one of the amalgamated factories, in fact, for Hart, Schaffner & Mark.
Mm-hmm. Amalgamated clothing?
Then it became amalgamated clothing.
Mm-hmm.
Asked the employer whether he couldn't bring in a friend to learn how to work in the trade. And he had agreed. And this was my first encounter. While I knew about unions, my brother belonged to a union when he came here and went to work. But that was my first encounter with unions, that after working there for about a half a year, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, that had its national office in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
took down the shop where I worked on strike for union recognition. And we were out on strike for only a half a day,
mm-hmm.
and we were sent back to work with a union contract, which lowered the hours primarily. And wages were not the consideration at that time. Hart, Schaffner & Mark was a big concern, and every floor, I believe I worked at that time on the 6th or on the 8th floor, I remember the street that I worked mm-hmm. on Jackson and Holston. And when we came to every floor, had its own little office with a timekeeper who would keep track of, you know, who comes in, because we had a bunch of time clock,
mm-hmm.
you know, and service, whatever, if you needed some supplies, etc. And I remember when we came back to work with a union count, she came by the place where I was sitting, and very proudly I said, "Oh, Matt, we are getting a shortage of hours, and I small raise. What did you get?" And she turned around and looked at me. She was quite a big woman, and not as young. She looked to me at that time probably a woman in her 30s. Turned around and looked at me and said very arrogantly, "I do not belong to a union," which sort of made me realize that not everybody in this world is union conscious.
And you were 16 then,
in
your first strike.
That was my first encounter with a union. My first encounter also in the Amalgamated Union. They had carried out several strikes at that time, and naturally, as the union got more and more shops under their contract, they needed people mm-hmm. to service the shop. And one day, as I was working, the business agent, who's the manager, came into the shop where I worked and said to me, "Sophie," his name was at that time, William, who was in charge of that particular office, he says, "Frank Rosenblum wants to see you." He says, "After work, the union office, I worked on Jackson and Holstead. The union office was on Holstead and Jackson, practically around the corner. So after work, I stepped into the office, and Frank Rosenblum was waiting for me. He took me in his office, and he says to me, 'Sophie, we need a lot of business agents.'" we would like to consider you to become one of our business agents. And my reply to him was, but I don't know anything about how to be a business agent. And his reply to me was, well, you really don't have to know anything. We will tell you what to do. Well, that sort of, I got up and I said, I will never do anything that I don't know how to do, and somebody will have to tell me how to do it. He said, I'm sorry, I will remain working in the factory. So you see, I got at a very early age, I began to understand, number one, that not every worker is union conscious, and number two, that just to have a union is not enough. A union must have a working man's approach to it.
How long before you went to work for the International Ladies' Garment Workers
Union shop? That was in 1932, when my husband was very ill, and so although I didn't know that he would die so early, but nevertheless, I had to go to work.
There was a period when you didn't work?
Yes. I was home and I raised a child and I didn't work. And I came into the Amalgamated office because I had worked under an Amalgamated office until I got married. And then I got married. In those days, I quit the job. I believe it was a month before I got married. That was the way of life in those days. So I came into the Amalgamated office. Came to the Amalgamated office and I told them that I must have a job. My husband is sick and I have to go to work. Already at that time there was a slight unemployment in the industry.
This in 32?
That was, yes, that was in 32. So they called me in into the business, into the office. They opened up the book and they said to me, here, choose any job you want. Which also irked me, even though I was in great need of a job. I didn't feel that I could take a job when there is an unemployment situation, and they did have unemployed workers. Therefore, I left there, and the next best thing that I could do is that my mother had a friend that had a dress shop, and he agreed to take me in and show me how to become a dress operator.
Mm-hmm.
In 1932, there was already the struggles in the ILG have continued since 1910. And in the late 20s, that has developed not only in the ILG, but throughout the trade union movement, even though it was small at that time, Trade Union Unity League, which was the beginnings of a rank-and-file movement of unions. And therefore, knowing all these things, when I did get a job in this place, I went to the Industrial Union, which was part of the Trade Union Unity League, which was a rank-and-file oriented union.
Was this like a pre-runner for the CIO?
Yes, definitely. And I had joined the Industrial Union of the Garment Workers. And in 1933, when the general strike was called, that was when President Roosevelt issued the NRA and gave the Labor Relations Act, where union workers have a right to organize into unions. And the ILG called the general strike. The Industrial Union dissolved itself and felt that one strong union would be of greater benefit to the people than to maintain a rank and file small union organization. And since 1933, I've been a member of the ILG until I retired in 1965.
Now, were working conditions when you went back to work in 1933 worse because of the depression than
they had been
in the 20s?
They were worse in this sense. The workers from the 20s until 1932 have, as I said, there have been rank and file movements and union organization, And they weren't anymore that foreign group that came here and didn't know how to go
right.
about organizing unions. But since the garment industry is a stylized industry, and the union contract is not like any other union contract where you sign your contract for a year or two or three, and this is the contract under which you work. It was a stylized industry and a piecework industry, which meant that every time the style changed, there had to be negotiations for prices,
mm-hmm.
which actually put the burden of the conditions on the people working in a given factory.
Right.
And depending on the ability of the workers to negotiate with their employers, this is how the condition existed. But since there was no union organization yet in 1932, when I worked in the industry, arbitrarily, I remember it was only several months before the general strike. I was a member of the industrial union, which was powerless and couldn't, and I worked in a large factory where the father of the employer happened to be Jewish, a very religious Jew. And because I was Jewish and he knew that I had a child at home, because I always made that condition that I must be available for phone calls
mm-hmm.
because I'm leaving a child at home.
Was that, did you have problems with that?
Oh yes. But he sort of let me, see,
mm-hmm.
and I did not work Saturdays there. I claimed that Saturdays is against my convictions, which really wasn't so, but I felt I needed that Saturday day or half a day. So he would give me preferred work in order to be able to earn more money.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, even there, one Monday morning, we came into work, and the garment that we were getting, $1.28 for making it, they cut it to 65 cents. So the conditions while they were, we worked already then 44 hours, we did not work, you know, 15 more hours. But nevertheless, conditions were bad because of the depression. And there was no use quitting the job because there was nothing better or nothing else to give. So therefore, when the call for the general strike came, you know, I gave greater details of that in my talk. You know, it was a complete shutdown of the industry.
Of the entire garment industry?
Of the entire garment industry.
And how long did it last?
It lasted 2 weeks. But at the end of the 2 weeks, we got the 35-hour week. We were the very first ones, the very few unions today, who work 35 hours a week, and extra hours have to be paid time and a half. After 35 hours, since 1933. And systems have been established on how to settle prices, but it was a constant struggle,
mm-hmm.
and it is until today, because of it being a stylized industry, which it is impossible to set rates, not unless it would be a time working.
What kinds of things did you do during the strike?
Oh, it was because the entire industry was shut down. It was really more of a picnic than anything else. We would all come down in every area so far, to my knowledge, has a specific garment area, since they congregate into
mm-hmm.
one certain area. And we would congregate at that time in Chicago, around, also on Jackson Boulevard and near Canal Street. There would be thousands of people in the street. We would sing songs. And carry on, it was really more of a picnic than a strike, because we felt certain no one is there taking our jobs, and many of us, not I wouldn't vouch that for all the thousands of workers, but many of us realize that as long as there is no production, the employers will be forced
right.
to recognize union recognition and establish decent wages.
There was a lot of unity among you then.
Complete unity. And in Chicago, for instance, the great majority of people that worked in the industry, although the Jews were a sizable minority, they were not the largest. was Polish,
mm-hmm.
because the ethnic composition of in Chicago in those years, the Polish people were the largest minority, and black. At that time, that was the only people that worked in Chicago in the industry, were the Jews, the Poles, and the black. And there was tremendous unity among these people. I can just picture before my eyes now, the streets were blocked off. There was no traffic or anything because, you know, the garment industry has a peculiar set of traffic mm-hmm. constantly going. Well, there was nothing happening there because no one was working. So in all the black, the Poles,